But I do want to just talk for a minute about exactly where we find ourselves. Because it really is at one of these moments, one of these few moments, maybe only the second moment really in human history, when we face a test of such enormous dimension that to fail, it would be terminal. The first of these tests, one that so far, thanks to people like the people in this room, we've kind of, well, at least we've been passing, more or less. The first of them came with the new 20th century technology of nuclear weapons and the understanding that all of a sudden it was within our power to change everything all at once. You know, the vision for me is always of Oppenheimer standing there at the first explosion at Alamogordo and looking up at this fireball and quoting from the Gita and saying, "We are become as gods, destroyers of worlds." And that had never been a possibility for human beings before, and all of a sudden it was. And so far, we have been able to head off that great trauma. So far, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we haven't done it again. Which is a good sign, a sign of humans' ability to understand the danger they're in and then to do something about it. I think one reason we were able to do something about it was that it was easy for us to picture in our minds the effects of those huge explosions. You know, they made visceral sense to us. It was harder to imagine that the explosion of billions of pistons and billions of cylinders every hour of every day around this planet could have the same scale of effect, but in fact, that's what turns out to be happening. That's what climate change is. So far, we've put enough carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, burned enough coal and gas and oil to raise the temperature of the Earth 1 degree, which does not actually sound like that much. I mean, if the temperature changes 1 degree between the time we walked in and the time we walk out, none of us will be able to tell the difference. But it turns out that the Earth can tell the difference. It means that we're trapping about 0.75 watts of extra solar energy per square meter of the Earth's surface. Again, that doesn't sound like much. It's less than one of those small white Christmas tree lights per square meter of the Earth's surface, but there turn out to be a lot of square meters of the Earth's surface, and aggregated together, it turns into an enormous quantity of energy on the scale of several hundred thousand Hiroshima-sized bombs, that much energy. And we have a sense now of how much energy that adds up to because we can see its effects around us. A few days ago, got new cryosat data from the satellites that circle above the North Pole. And what they told us was we only have about 20% of the summer sea ice left in the Arctic that we did 40 years ago. 80% of it's gone. We smashed through every record for Arctic ice melt last summer. We broke the old record by about August 16th with a month to go. By the time we were done, I mean, just, you know, well, we really had broken one of the biggest physical features on Earth, and the other one's close behind. You know, we're near the ocean here, the beautiful Atlantic, and this Connecticut shore is a particularly beautiful place. My wife went to school here. She grew up in Norwalk, and so we, you know, I know secondhand at least a little bit. It's part of the world, and it's very beautiful, but the water out there is very different from when she was growing up. It's 30% more acidic because the chemistry of seawater changes as it absorbs carbon from the atmosphere. This had not even occurred to us 25 years ago when I wrote The End of Nature. The oceans are our metaphor for vastness. We did not think we could actually do much to them, certainly not change their pH, but we have. For those of us on land, The thing we notice first, I think, is changes in hydrology, in the way that water moves around the planet. If you want one fact to understand our century, it's that warm air holds more water vapor than cold. As a result, the atmosphere is 5% wetter than it was. That's a lot. That's a staggering change in a basic physical parameter. It loads the dice for drought and flood, and we are seeing both in astonishing quantities every day someplace around the world. We've seen epic droughts in Africa. We've seen last summer's remarkable drought across the richest farmland in the world. And we've also seen rainstorms of completely unprecedented proportion, place after place after place. This afternoon, apparently, it was Chicago's turn, and they had rained like more than they'd ever measured at this time of the year in the whole history of the place, and causing enormous quick flooding. The week before that, it was Buenos Aires. They had what they described as a tsunami of rainfall, a completely unprecedented event. 50 or 60 people died, drowned in their cars, you know. And it's always like this now someplace around the world, and sometimes much worse in 2010. In 2010, record rainfall along the headwaters of the Indus River up in the mountains of Pakistan. And by the time that it worked its way down across the whole nation, 25% of Pakistan was underwater. 20 million people were out of their homes. It's as if Hurricane Sandy had made everybody from Baltimore to Boston, you know, have to evacuate their houses. But of course, Hurricane Sandy was bad enough. It was certainly a reminder to us of what's going on, to see the greatest city in the world, to see the New York City subway system filled with the Atlantic Ocean, was to be reminded in no uncertain terms of the fragility of this arrangement that we call civilization in the face of the change that we are now making. A change that, unless we get to work very, very rapidly, will be very, very much worse. We've raised the temperature 1 degree. The same scientists who told us that that would happen and predicted its results, predicted them, by the way, with fairly eerie specificity. You can go find lots of reports saying which subway stations in New York City were going to flood when the first big storm came, and they were exactly right about what was going to go on. Okay? The same scientists told us all that. Now tell us with robust confidence that unless we stop burning coal and gas and oil far more quickly than any government currently plans to, that 1 degree will be 4 or 5 degrees before the youngest people in this room are old people. And there is no reason to think that our civilization can even begin to cope with change on that scale. The agronomists, Stanford, University of Washington, I put out a study 2 years ago now. It said from this point on, they just didn't even look at drought and flood. They just looked at what happens to our main grain crops as the temperature rises, okay? Because those evolved over the last 10,000 years to be, you know, used to the climate that we've had. What they found was that from this point on, each degree increase in global average temperature should cut grain yields about 10%. And watching what happened in Iowa last summer, it's easy to see how that could happen. Try to imagine the planet that we're on, with all that you know about it, with a temperature 2 or 3 degrees higher and therefore 20 or 30% fewer calories. Okay? Just run that in your mind and try to figure out whether any of the things you care about development, about public health, about war and peace, can possibly be sustained in that kind of world. I don't think they can. This is the biggest thing that human beings have ever done, by far. The most important thing that happened in the lifetime of everyone in this room was that we left behind the Holocene, this 10,000-year period of benign climatic stability that underwrote the rise of human civilization, and now we've moved into something else, and the only question is how far into it we're going to move. So the stakes are enormous. enormous and very basic. And the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration put out a study in January saying that the world had grown hot enough and muggy enough already that the capacity of human beings to work outdoors has already been reduced about 10%, and by mid-century on current trends would be reduced about 30%. That's about as basic as it gets, you know. The idea that we're making it too hot for us to go outside and do what human beings have always done, you know, raise the food we need to feed ourselves, whatever it is. So, the really grim stuff's over now, and we'll move on a little bit to a slightly different sort of order of grimness, which is about trying to answer the question of why we haven't done anything about this so far, okay? It's not for lack of warning. Scientists, this was a remarkable case of science telling us precisely what we needed to know. And the amazing amount of human brain power put to work on this project, beginning a long time ago, beginning in 1890s when Arrhenius, the great Swedish chemist, first did the kind of back of the envelope calculations about what would happen if we continued, as he put it, to evaporate our coal mines into the air. We knew already that the molecular structure of CO2 trapped heat, and so he was able to calculate numbers that come not that far from what our supercomputers now tell us about what the future holds, you know. But really, a human effort that gained power in the 1970s and 1980s as we built computing capacity large enough to really crack. And by 1988, James Hansen, our greatest scientific hero, testified before Congress. He said, it's time to stop waffling and say that the planet's heating up and that we're the cause. And then the rest of the scientific community, in the powerful dialectic that they employ, tried to knock him down, you know? That's how it's supposed to work in that community, and they did their best. And by 1995, the rest of the world scientific community was, okay, this is correct. This is what's going on. We need to get to work. But we didn't get to work. We didn't get to work anywhere, especially in the United States. We've had a 25-year bipartisan effort in Washington to accomplish nothing, and it's been entirely successful, okay? And and one needs to ask why that is. And we could come up with a long list of reasons, but frankly, the biggest one, the most important one, is that the richest industry on Earth has been able to completely block change of any significant kind. The fossil fuel industry has all the money. I mean, almost literally. Exxon made more money last year than any company in the history of money. Okay? They are the 1% of the 1%. And of course, it only takes a little bit of that money to corrupt political systems enough to make sure that change doesn't happen. Keeping change from happening is a relatively easy thing to do, at least compared with trying to make change happen. Okay? So they've been up to the task so far. They've been able to defend the greatest special privilege that there ever was and the source of their great wealth, which is that they're the one industry that gets to throw out their waste for free. They're allowed to pour carbon into the atmosphere without cost. And every economist that I know of in this country 25 years ago started saying this is an externality, to use their language, that we must force them to internalize. They have to pay the price of carbon. Otherwise, it'll forever be an unfair competition with the kind of energy sources that don't pour carbon into the atmosphere. Okay? But the fossil fuel industry has been sufficiently skilled to keep that from happening. There was an interesting expose today, a very good one, about what's been going on in California, where Chevron, the oil company, who gave the largest campaign donation in the post-Citizens United world, where Chevron's been battling to undermine California's environmental regulations with some success. And there was just a fascinating quote in it from a vice president of Chevron who had since quit. And he said, if you're an oil company, what you want is for nothing ever to change. And that's absolutely right. And you want it because you are an absolutely stripped down and incredibly simple machine with only one goal in mind, which is to make more money. The CEO of Exxon, Rex Tillerson, gave an interview on Charlie Rose 2 or 3 weeks ago. And Charlie Rose tossed him a real softball question. He said, tell me what your philosophy is. And I think he expected he would say something about helping improve the world. Or he said, looked him straight in the eye and said, my philosophy is to make money. Okay, and that's exactly right. High marks for honesty. And the way that they make money is that they burn stuff, they dig stuff up for us to burn. I did a piece last summer for Rolling Stone that went strangely viral. It became it was in the issue with Justin Bieber on the cover. For those of you that keep your back issues, okay, the funny part was that the editor called up the next day and said, "You have your piece has 10 times as many likes on Facebook as Justin Bieber's." Very impressive. The point of the piece, the burden of the piece, was that there was new data assembled by a bunch of financial analysts that demonstrated quite compellingly that the fossil fuel industry now had 5 times as much coal and oil and gas in their reserves as even the most conservative governments or scientists on Earth think is safe to burn. 5 times what is necessary to take us past the 2-degree threshold that's already an alarmingly high target for temperature increase. In other words, it's a rogue industry. These are outlaw companies, not outlaw against the laws of the state because they get to write those, but outlaw against the laws of physics, okay? And hence need to be opposed. That's why we weren't getting anywhere. It wasn't because the scientists hadn't won the argument and the economists hadn't put out the policy that we needed and so on. It was because we were overwhelmed by the money that came from the other side. And I'd spent most of my adult life writing about these things, but it hadn't occurred to me that my job would be to try and figure out how to do something about it. I thought my function was to write. But at a certain point, I figured out we were just losing and that we needed to do something different. And I didn't know what because, I'd read a little bit about Gandhi and stuff, but I didn't really know how to do any of this stuff. But I came back from that trip that John described to Bangladesh, having watched all these people die from dengue fever. And it's completely horrible to do it horrible any place, but to do it in Bangladesh, there's 150 million people there, but when the UN tries to measure how much carbon they've emitted, you can't even get a number. It's just a rounding error. They don't burn enough fossil fuel to even matter, And yet they're paying huge price. We're responsible for upwards of a third of all the CO2 currently in the atmosphere, the 4% of us who live in the United States. This is our legacy, our main legacy to the world, really, at this point. So I wanted to do something, but I had no idea how to do this. Sue will remember, my first thought was I would call a few of my writer friends up in Vermont. Said, we're going to go up to the federal building in Burlington, which is our main city. It's only got 50,000 people, so not that main, but it's what we've got, And we'll go up there and we'll sit in on the steps of the federal building and we'll get arrested and there'll be a story in the newspaper and at least we will have done something, And these guys, all these writers, as clueless as I was, oh, that's a good idea, let's do that. But one of them thought to call up to the police in Burlington, say, what would happen were we to pull off this intrepid stunt, And the police said, nothing will happen. Stay there as long as you want. So we had to recalibrate, And we left. We did that. I said, I just emailed everybody I know and said, we're going to go for a walk, you know. And we left from Robert Frost's old summer riding cabin up in the Green Mountains. We walked for 5 days north to Burlington and slept in farm fields at night. I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher sometimes, so I'd called up the Methodist mafia en route to make sure they'd be potluck suppers, which kind of the Methodist sacrament, you know, would be available as we walked. And by the time we got to Burlington, there were 1,000 people marching, which for Vermont, only like University of Vermont hockey game would draw more, you know, more people than that at one time. In fact, we got to the outskirts of town, and my great friend and our greatest political leader, I think, Bernie Sanders, was there to greet us. And Bernie, an old-time organizer, was as happy as he could be. He was sort of bouncing up and down. He said, "This is great. This is great. I haven't seen anything like this since Vietnam. This is so great. What is this about again?" He said. He's since gone on to be just our greatest climate champion in the whole Senate. I mean, just wonderful. But the thing that was depressing was to open the newspaper the next day and read this story that said that 1,000 people that gathered there was probably the largest demonstration about climate change that had yet taken place in the United States. This was 2006. When I read that, I thought, no wonder we lose. We've got the superstructure of a movement. We've got Al Gore. We've got the scientists. We've got the policy people. The only part of the movement we forgot was the movement part. There's nothing there, you know, and that's what we're going to have to build. So that's what we started trying to build. And 350.org, we started shortly after. And when I say we, I mean me and 7 undergraduates at Middlebury College, 7 seniors, which, you know, we had no money or organization or anything. We had this name, which we took from Jim Hansen, who told us 350 parts per million CO2 was the most we could safely have in the atmosphere, a number we're already sadly well north of. We took it mostly because we wanted to organize globally, and the thing we were most worried about was how we would communicate across language barriers. And, you know, Arabic numerals travel, as you saw in that beautiful video that someone put together at the beginning. All over the world, people figured out what these numbers meant and went to work. It was, when we started, we had no, there were 7 undergraduates and there were 7 continents, so each one took one, you know. And the guy who took the Antarctic also had to take the internet. And we set out, and we, you know, within a year, we had this first big day of action, which had 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries. And one of the things that it proved was that having an organization made up entirely of 21-year-olds was not a handicap. It was a great advantage, because they knew how to use these new tools that we now have that allow suddenly organizing on a different kind of scale and things. And it was beautiful. Over the next 2 or 3 years, we did 3 or 4 of these huge global days of action. We've had about 20,000 rallies, every country in the earth except North Korea. Tremendous amount of climate education that got done, and then very necessary. That's part of what, but it's insufficient by itself to the task at hand. So we've been trying hard and consciously to sort of try and deepen this work, this movement. And our decision to go after the Keystone Pipeline and to do it with civil disobedience was very conscious. This is a huge pool of carbon up in Canada that no one knew anything about. And to build the pipeline, and this was the other key part, you need a permit signed by the President of the United States. Congress, because of a kind of arcane law about infrastructure that crosses the border, Congress has nothing to do with it. It's up to the President. And so we figured there was a chance, and we figured I'd spent the winter teaching a course at Middlebury College, where I hang out some of the time, and the course was on, well, I don't even really quite remember what it was on, but the high point of it was that we read Taylor Branch's amazing 3-volume biography of Dr. King in America in the Civil Rights Years, which is such a great book and so detailed that if you're an organizer, it's like a handbook for organizing, you know. And one of the things that it brought home to me, and that work like Dan's was bringing home at the same time, was that civil disobedience was probably a thing we'd neglected for too long in this country. And when we decided to do it, it was a sort of conscious effort to experiment and to see if there was support in the environmental community for ramping things up some. And I was really pleased to find out that there was. The people that we found, capitalism being the great thing that it is, there's somebody to do everything in this world, and we found a team of people in Washington whose expertise and career was in arranging civil disobedience, you know, a crew of people that have now become our great friends and, you know, colleagues. But we hired them, and they were very, you know, eager to go to work, but they kept saying, you have to understand, I told them, we're going to do this for 2 weeks. We're going to get people arrested every day at the White House. And they said, you have to understand, we can do it, but it'll be 4 or 5 people a day. Because they'd been doing this for a long time, and that's sort of the scale that this had been going on at, you know. And I said, no, I think we'll get more. I think that there are more people out there worried about this. And indeed, when we got there that first day with Dan, Annie, and there were 80 or 90 of us there waiting to get arrested, which was way more than we expected and way more than the police expected. And that's why we got to go to jail, because the police knew that there was 2 weeks of this plan and they didn't want it. And they said, we're going to try to deter you. So instead of doing what they normally do in Washington, which is just take you to the police station and fine you $100, and that's what we were expecting. I think everybody had $100 in their pocket. They instead took us to Central Cell Block in D.C. for 3 days and 2 nights, which was just as much fun as it sounds like it would be, you know? I remember at one point Dan from several cells down saying, God, they must hate you guys much worse than they hate us, he said. which was fun. But it worked the way that civil disobedience is supposed to do. It both brought attention to the problem and underlined the moral urgency and helped us kick off this campaign that so far has kept this cursed pipeline at bay for a year and a half, and so kept, you know, 500 million barrels or so of this tar sands oil in the ground. Now, I don't know if we're going to win this fight. The odds have been against us from the very beginning, all the way, because there's, by conservative estimate, $20 trillion worth of oil up there in those tar sands, if you can get it all out. There's enough to take the atmospheric concentration of CO2 from its current 400 parts per million to 540 parts per million, okay? And the people who own the leases on that land are people like, say, the Koch brothers, who are real good at getting their way, you know? So we may well... lose it, and if we do, that'll be bad, but it's triggered all kinds of other organizing, including great organizing now in Canada, especially among First Nations people who have blocked the pipeline to the Pacific that they wanted to build, and it's complicated the lives in a lot of ways of these oil companies, and we intend to complicate their lives further. We intend to do more than simply play defense, important as that is, against bad projects. We're determined to play some offense, too. Hence this divestment movement that we launched that's now quickly spread to more than 300 college campuses. And, you know, we did it because once I'd written that piece for Rolling Stone and we were kind of understanding the implications of that corporate power, we looked around for the models of successfully standing up to big corporate power, and there are not as many as one might want, really. But one of them, maybe the foremost, is the organizing that went on in apartheid times to try, and I'm sure there's people in this room who were engaged in that work. And you know, when Nelson Mandela got out of prison, took his foreign trip when he first came to the United States, and he did not go first to the White House or Washington. He went first to the University of California to say thanks to the students who had forced the divestment of $3 billion worth of stock there. And he said, now, of course, we fought for our own liberation in South Africa, but we could not have done it without that kind of pressure from the outside too, you know. His great colleague, Desmond Tutu, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in that struggle, made a video that we showed as we did this tour around the country last fall, trying to spark the interest in this divestment movement. And the video was very poignant and beautiful. He's an older man now, Desmond Tutu, but you know, one of the great heroes of our time. And he said, if you could see what's happening in Africa, the drought, the famine, the spread of disease that comes with climate change in Africa, if you could see it, you would understand why I'm asking you to take up this same peaceful weapon again that you took up in the fight against apartheid. Because, you know, people need to be free, and people also need to eat. And so it's really good to see that starting to blossom on campus after campus, and now city government after city government. The city of Seattle divested recently of its fossil fuel stock, saying, we're spending millions of dollars building seawalls. Why would we be investing our money in the companies that make it necessary for us to do this? You know, and it's spreading quickly to religious denominations. John, you will be happy to know. UCC, United Church of Christ, is going to take a vote this summer on divestment. The Uniting Church of Australia, the main Protestant denomination in Australia, divested 2 days ago, which is a big deal in a country based on coal mining at the moment. I mean, very, very powerful witness. And I think and I hope that it'll continue. And I think all of this needs to continue and needs to get much larger. I did another piece for Rolling Stone last week, talking about the emergence of what I've taken to calling just this fossil fuel resistance here and around the world. And it has no central organization and no charismatic leader, no Dr. King, you know, not even a Dan Choi, you know, but it's wonderful to see it happen. All the things that people are doing in 1,000 local places to stand up to the coal-fired power plant that's driving up asthma rates, to stand up to the pipeline that's going through their backyard, to stand up as part of 350 or whatever else. All those things kind of knit together, and we're going to knit them together further. We'll announce in the next few days what we're going to call summer heat, this 10 days in the end of July that are statistically the hottest days of the summer, and that we're going to try and make the politically hottest days with distributed civil disobedience at many of these local fights around the country, making it clear to people that, you know, Keystone's important, but there's a lot of other things that are important too. And we're going to do it around the world. In 6 weeks or so, we'll be in Istanbul. 350 is hosting what we call Global Power Shift, and there'll be 500 young people from 165 countries. We had 5,000 applications for this thing, and we're going to turn them all into just teams of crack organizers that can go back where they are and spread trouble as quickly as trouble can be spread. And I will just finish by saying that the time has come, at least in the environmental movement, to really take the example that comes from Gandhi in the 20th century and so much of the work reflected by so many of the people who've been honored with this prize and put it straight to work. Now in our time, in a battle with even higher stakes, than any of the battles that we've fought before, because what happens now will determine for geologic time what this planet looks like. There were two things about those big mass arrests that we did in the summer of 2011, which turned into be the largest civil disobedience action about anything in this country in 30 years. 1,253 people went to jail over the course of those 2 weeks. And there were two things about them that interested me. And one of them, I say, looking around at the demographic diversity represented here, one of the things that I said when I wrote the letter asking people to come get arrested, which is not an easy letter to write, I find, but seemed necessary. One of the things I said was, I don't actually think college kids should have to be the cannon fodder this time around. If you're 22 right now, in our economy, perhaps an arrest record not the thing that you absolutely most need. One of the few unmixed blessings of growing older is, past a certain point, what the hell are they going to do to you? You know, you basically get a free pass. You know, I mean, it made me really happy to see people with hairlines like mine, you know, arriving in Washington. Now, we did not say to people, how old are you? Because that would be rude. But we did quite cleverly say, who was president when you were born? And the two biggest cohorts came from the FDR and the Truman administrations. Okay. On the last day, there was a guy arrested with a sign around his neck that said, World War II vet, handle with care. Okay. And he'd been born in the Warren Harding administration, which, history student though I was, I confess I'd forgotten there was a Warren Harding administration. You know. That was really good to see, and it was really heartening for the young people who have really been leading this fight everywhere to see their elders acting like elders, you know, doing that kind of work. So make sure you're signed up at 350.org, because we're going to ask you again. We're going to give you, in fact, it's funny, I've had a number of people come up to me since and say, you know what, it's on my bucket list now to go to jail for something. Oh, okay. The second thing we told people, and this was a little more unusual, second thing we told people was, if you're going to come get arrested, would you please wear a necktie or dress, okay? Now, I wore a necktie tonight, but as Sue will tell you, that's fairly rare. You know, basically, in Vermont, we just sort of swaddle ourselves in fleece and try to make it through the winter. You know, that's the, you know, we're not. But we wanted to make a point, and I think it's an important point that's worth making, which is that, as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing radical at all about what we're asking for in the environmental fight. All we're asking for is a world that works like the one that we were born into, and that all human beings whose history we know about were born into. That's not actually a radical demand at all. If anything, it's a highly conservative demand. Radicals work at oil companies. Okay? If you're willing to get up in the morning and make your money, that is your one goal in life, apparently, if you're willing to do that by altering the chemical composition of the atmosphere in defiance of every climate scientist, and now with the visual proof that the, you know, polar ice cap has melted, if you're willing to do that, then you are a far more radical actor than any human before you, you know? And it's our job to figure out, in this case, how to kind of check that radicalism, to let some kind of just basic common sense carry the day, you know? And that's the compelling, consuming fight that we're in. I do not know if we will win it. And the reason I don't know is because it's one of the first fights we've ever been in that comes with a very sharp time limit. One of the most interesting things about Gandhi was his incredible patience, you know, that in the 20s and 30s, he built up the first round of this great nonviolent fervor in India. But then when the British cracked down for the first time, when there was the massacre at the bazaar, Amritsar, and things, then Gandhi said, you know what, we're not ready yet, we're going to back off, we're going to slow down, we're going to climb for a decade or more, emphasized other work, emphasized practical work, you know, as he called it, work, and village industry and all those kind of things, saying we're building up the sort of strength of character that Dr. King the same way, you know. Dr. King always ended every speech with that quote from, I think from Theodore Parker maybe, saying, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. It may take us a while, but we're going to win, you know. The famous speech he gave the night before he was shot, remembering Moses on the mountain. I may not get there with you, but you will get there, there is no doubt. Well, the arc of the physical universe is short in this case, and it bends toward heat. And if we don't quickly get things under control, then we won't ever get them under control, because the physics of the situation means that the feedback loops that start kicking in take it past our ability to control. And that's why it seems so desperately important and urgent to me to be sort of out everywhere we can trying to fan this particular fight. I don't know that we're going to win, but I do know now, and this was something that even a few months ago I don't think I could have said, but I do rest somewhat easy in the knowledge that we're at least going to fight, that there's going to be a serious, 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 peaceful, nonviolent, beautiful fight. Don't know if we're going to win. Do look forward to being shoulder to shoulder with y'all in that fight. Thank you all very much. Thank you.